Hi, I'm Chris Caldwell, and welcome to Season 3 of Conversations on Climate. We sit down with the experts who are trying to solve the biggest challenge of our time before time runs out. Our coverage of Africa has improved enormously this century. It's more than just the 80s cycle of famine and war. We're now telling different, more positive stories too. That said, find a positive article about East Africa today, for example, and I bet we'll be talking about how young the population is, you know, how vibrant the politics are, or how the digital economy is booming. So the question is, have we become stuck on a new set of African cliches about this huge, diverse, and really exciting continent? And what about the fact that this region is at the forefront and the front line of climate chaos today? Now, I wanted to get beneath the same old story, and I've discovered the perfect guide to get us there. As part of the Green Vision Summit, I'm speaking today with their ambassador, Anita Sonia. She's a proud Maasai woman, green activist and youth champion who at just 24 years of age has already done more for the environment than most of us will fit into a lifetime. She explains how to turn young people into climate warriors, why she ran for parliament at the age of just 22, and what Westerners can learn from indigenous African philosophy. It's an inspiring, sometimes difficult, but always empowering conversation. So stay with us for another conversation on climate. Around 80% of people who listen to this podcast haven't hit the follow button. If I could ask you for a small favor, if you do enjoy our conversations, please do hit that follow button on your app. It would help us in the show more than I could possibly say. Thank you, and enjoy the conversation. Okay, Anita, well, thank you so much for joining us here for another conversation on climate. You've achieved so much at the age of just 24. Climate activist, UN youth advocate, author, charity founder. Like, I don't know whether we'll be able to fit all of this in this kind of 30-40 minute conversation. But could you, to start with, tell us briefly about your background and how you got involved in climate work?
So I'm Anita Soina from Maasai community here in Kenya. The Maasai community is famously known for their culture, but also one of the communities that are most affected by climate change and especially droughts, where when there's no rainfall, it's worse droughts. And when there's rainfall, it's floods. So there's a lack of balance. And my journey as an environmentalist first started when I was joining university. That was in 2018. And that is because in 2017, I joined politics after completing my high school. And while in the political space, I met an individual who asked me why I was in the political space at such a young age. I wasn't even eligible to vote, but I was very active in the political scenes. And I shared with him that I just wanted to be active in spaces where we can contribute to issues that affect us, the social issues that affect us, and also that I'd love to give back. Having been a member of the scouting club in my secondary school, I was a chairperson of scouting club at some point, and so we had a lot of giving back activities. So after I shared that small background to him, he asked me whether I had ever interacted with sustainable development goals. And at that time, I had never had of something like that. I had never seen, I didn't know what it meant. And that is when he introduced me to the SDGs and monitored me to learn different SDGs. And he asked me that, what do I think I'm comfortable in supporting? And so at that time, I remember I was keen on fundraising with friends to support the street children and visit children homes and so basically charity. But then as time went by, I found it easy to just go out and plant trees with friends. And so I started by planting trees. We'd go out on weekends in university, just plant trees, and that was it. So over time, attending workshops, attending seminars, attending conferences, events where people are speaking, I was able to understand the nexus between climate and so many things. And I was able to expand my knowledge and also my scope of work. And I remember that time I was still trying to figure out, because when we were growing up and what we had about climate change was just, you know, change of weather in a longer period of time, and that was it. But I didn't know when we came out here, the conversation on climate change uses tough language. So it took me a while to really understand. So the droughts that we have in some parts of Kenya is what climate change is. So do you mean the floods that we see? So I started to relate that climate change is not far from us. It's not something that was going to come later. It was something that was already with us, just that maybe in spaces that we interact in, we never get to realize that climate change is as simple as what we face in our own country. And that is when I decided to say that if I identify a problem and I think I can add my voice to it, I can add little actions to it, then why not be an environmental champion? And then over time, I grew using my social media platforms, where my social media platforms were growing because I also worked in the music and entertainment industry as an artist manager. And so trying to convince my followers that it's climate now, guys, I'm not talking music anymore, was not easy. I lost so many of them. But still in the process, I knew that this is what I wanted to do. That is when I learned about so many great people like the late Professor Wangari Maathai. And also in the process, I got so many questions going for TV interviews and people asking me, where did you get the passion? I couldn't really give an exact answer of why I gave the passion. But just to appreciate that I also grew up with my grandfather sometimes when I was growing up, and he was a champion of environmental conservation, even though I never understood what he was doing and I never championed for it. But then I tend to think, maybe as one of his favorite grandchildren, maybe I also got the passion from him. So, yeah.
Amazing, amazing. So before we dig into some of the details in there, that was really, really great kind of piece of background there. The reason that we got introduced was because of through the Green Vision Summit in Malta, where you're an ambassador. Could you tell us, like, what does that mean to you and what do you hope to achieve by taking up that position?
First of all, taking a position where you are a global ambassador, it means you're in a position where you are speaking to people from all over the world, but you are also listening and learning from people all over the world. Getting that role to be the global ambassador, one of the global ambassadors, to me is also communicated that the work that we do, no matter how small we think it is being seen elsewhere in the world. And by them giving me this opportunity, it's them telling me that we see you, we hear you, and we appreciate you. So that's an appreciation of the work that we do, and not just myself, but also the communities that I represent and the communities that I work with.
So now we could talk a little bit about climate change in Kenya. You've already kind of opened up that subject a little bit. So you're a Maasai woman from the south of Kenya. Climate change is real in Kenya. It isn't just an abstract something that people are worried about coming down the line. It's already arrived. Could you tell us a little bit about how climate change is affecting your region today, and what's the impact on the traditional environmental relationship that Maasai have with the land?
So, yeah, first of all, the Maasai community and other Maas speakers, because Maasai is just a subtype of the larger community that consists of other livestock keepers. It means that we keep livestock, not just for culture, but also for livelihoods. And for period of time, we've had droughts. It's not something that we just started to experience recently, but over years, it's been getting worse and worse. In 2022, we had the drought that was named the worst drought in 40 years. And that means loss of lives, that means loss of livelihoods, that means loss of livestock. And if for example, during the drought that I'm just talking about, that is when the one region where I come from lost over 500,000 cattle. And those are just the ones that statistics were taken. Not everybody registered how many cattle they lost. And in the process, during such droughts, you normally find that there is movement, there is migration from one place to another in search of water and pasture. Now, what happens during these migrations is that Usually it's the men or the fathers that do leave to take care of the cattle, leaving behind the children and the mothers. So you realize that the fathers are the breadwinners. They provide. And once they are away, the family is left with challenges on how to even fend for food. Now, when it comes to fetching water, for example, it's women and girls, according to culture, who do that. So they leave. You realize that this also affects schools. It affects education because then there is the schools are registering less number of girls, or even sometimes all students, just both boys and girls, don't show up in school because challenges are equally there. And I remember that time we once visited one of the schools in Kajiado, west part of it, and the situation was very dire. We found that the population of the school had decreased because some children had moved with their parents in search of water and pasture, and some had not come to school because they even had nothing to eat and nothing to drink. And so when we got to the school, we were going for a menstrual hygiene management. And when we got there, we realized that's not what the girls wanted. That's not what the school wanted. They have food in the store, but they don't even have water to cook the food. So we had to find people to buy water and transport it to them. And I think this is also looking at how food production is affected. But most importantly, it has affected culture, because right now the government is asking citizens from that region to move away from livestock farming to start to find other ways of livelihoods. And so you realize this is a whole community which is likely to lose its culture that they've had for long to just because we have climate change and it being a threat. And also looking at during migration, there's a lot of conflict that come out of that. In the process, people are killed, livestock are also killed. And this is because when I am herding my cattle and I pass through land that has grass, I will not ignore, it doesn't matter. So I'll have to push my cattle inside. And this is someone's land, no permission or nothing. So over time, that has also led to conflict, which causes loss of lives. And also looking at the nutrition of the children, and the nutrition of the children, the nutrition of the mothers during such times, pregnancy and when they're delivering, is usually not okay. So it also affects the mortality rate. And yeah, so we have the health effects, the social effects, where it affects education, hygiene, food production. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and your foundation and work are make it very clear that there's deep stratification within the country as well. How does the climate crisis interact with that? Is it kind of bringing people together to try and find solutions, or is it driving greater inequality?
I can say both, because for sure, when we say that when climate change affects us, it doesn't affect us equally, it's not just in the aspect of continent or global south and global north, but also here in the country, when it affects us, it doesn't affect us equally. And looking at the fact that climate change is also the cause of so many other social challenges, then that is causing a big gap. And also, I can say it's also bringing people together, because when I joined the climate space, when I compare the time when I joined the climate space and right now, I realize that we've had more voices on board. We've had more young people who are coming up also trying to join this space. And so I can say it's because of the effects. You know, when the effects are clear, when the effects are worse, then it brings people to think together and say, what can we do from where we are? So I can say both.
The Maasai culture has got a relationship with land that's both economic and philosophical. What can we learn from Maasai culture as to how we should be respecting land, and how we should be interacting with land, and how we should be looking after nature?
I think I can say the Maasai community and the pastoralists in general here in Kenya have really been stewards of the planet in different ways. If you look, you'll realize that most national parks and reserves in Kenya if not all, sit in the most about 80% sit in the communal land that belongs to these pastoralists, the Maasai, Samburus, and the others. And for over a long period of time, they have coexisted even with wildlife. So they have preserved wildlife. They came to understand that this is part of us. And so I can say from that, we can learn that even from, and even using their own indigenous knowledge, they had ways in how they could interact with animals. We visit some of these places, and of course, having not grown up in a setup where we have wild animals, I get shocked to see that they are able to live freely in places where elephants are, and these are really dangerous animals, but because it's because they have, through their own ways and indigenous communication, they know how to interact and live in the same space with these animals. They have been taking care of these wildlife. And so also when it comes to land, for example, in Kenya, one of the biggest issues we have right now is producing food. But the biggest contributor that is causing that, apart from climate change, is also massive subdivision of land. So in other areas, the mass subdivision of land to tiny pieces that cannot be used to cultivate or produce food is an issue. But when you look at the lands that the Maasai people have, is that they even share. Because of culture, they even live in one central place and the other part can be used for livestock farming. So I think it's something that we can borrow from them and understand how we can plan ourselves properly so that we don't end up losing all the land just because we did mass subdivision. But I can equally say it's a challenge that the Maasai people are facing right now, realizing that because of financial muscles, because of also poverty conditions worsening in such areas, they are forced to sell out their land to companies and to individuals who are after mass subdivision of the same land. So I think that's also a challenge that they do face.
That's an enormous challenge, both economically and culturally. Is it possible to maintain that sense of humanity to others in the face of these economic challenges and these outside forces trying to pull that apart?
It is for sure possible to do it. It's just about goodwill and majorly political goodwill, because if we look at our leaders in some of the regions, for example, in my county where I come from, our governor has put up a rule and a law that there is no subdivision of land to a certain level, and that is working. So I think it's about political goodwill. It's about the people who have the power to give directives doing that. Otherwise, then it becomes hard when there is no law that protects these. So it, and because when it comes to humanity, you realize that as human beings, people are greedy. It's everyone for themselves, God for us, all kind of society. That in one way or another, it doesn't matter how important it is not to do so. If it benefits an individual, then they see the need to do so. So I think it's also being intentional. Our leaders not only putting up laws, but being intentional about doing so.
Okay. And another part of your work is you're a youth activist. And you come from a country that I believe 40% of the population is under the age of 15. Like that's the youngest continent on the planet, where the very large parts of the rest of the world are aging with declining populations. How does such a young population impact on the attitudes to the environment in Kenya?
Looking at the young people, and it's the African continent, we are a youthful continent, is that looking at innovations, for example, I'll say some of the creative innovations in the climate space and some of the creative solutions to different climate change effects are coming from young people. For example, we have one UN champion who makes bricks from plastic, and that is one of the best innovations that we have seen young people come up with. If you go to different farms, different organizations in the sustainability and climate space, you'll realize that most people that do work there are young people. But also to realize that young people are so vibrant, young people have the energy, young people are so passionate, and above all, we still have the time. So young people are literally the change makers, they are policy makers, they are implementers of solutions. And I like to touch on leadership, because I still believe that there's a big role that politics and leaders, politicians and leaders can do, is that as a country, we are starting to embrace young leaders in the political spaces. So once they get there and they champion for issues, it makes everything better. That's why we are trying to raise a generation of people who understand societal issues, so that when they end up to leadership spaces, they already understand the challenges, as compared to having just electing people who do not have passion or who are not interested in social issues, get to politics and then try to teach them once they're already there. So I think that's, and also looking at, for example, climate education that I'm largely invested in, my organization is full of young people. They are all youthful volunteers. And I'm so happy. There are times when I was the youngest in my organization, but I'm so happy that right now I'm not the youngest, and we have so many other young people and children included, is that even when we need to pass the message back home, we will need the young people, the educated young people, the informed young people, to be able to pass the message and to be great teachers when it comes to climate issues.
And you mentioned politics. Now it seems a good time to talk about your political career. Like in 2022, you stood as the you were the youngest person in the country to run for a seat in Parliament as a Green MP. That's a hugely kind of brave and ambitious thing to do. Where did you find the courage to take on like established politicians who were two or three times your age?
Yeah, I can say I still owe it to my grandfather, who, when I was young, he instilled the leadership information in me, because I spent some time with him, and it started from something little as listening to news and reading newspapers at a young age, which was not so common among my peers, because I'd go to school when we'd have a newspaper, everybody'd rush to the last page to see cars and other interesting, and maybe the middle page for fashion. But I'd read from the first page and read headlines and be interested in seeing what's happening. I think that really helped me, because then I was trying to stay informed on the matter, on matters of politics in my country. And by the time I decided to run, it was too early. I definitely knew that someday I was going to run for a political seat, but never expected that it was going to be that soon. So at that time, I just graduated, and I had arrived from COP26, which was my first international trip and also my first conference. And when we were at COP26, we had this one Friday climate strike. Young people called for a climate strike. There was a march. Greta was also leading the march. But when I got to that park, there was so many people, and it was not just young people. Old people too were there. People in wheelchairs were there. People came out in large numbers to support. And it hit me that, so this is how big this issue is. Because when you're just looking from my own perspective, from the perspective of my space, my country, I don't really get to see how serious the issue is. But when I go to a place and I see people from different corners of the world come out in large numbers, then for sure this climate thing is really scary. And so I got scared, and then most placards were addressing world leaders. Dear world leaders, listen to us. Dear leaders, do this. And I told myself, for sure, young people are out here. Communities are already doing something about, they are interested even in more information and on how they can change. So the problem is politics. Our leaders are the problem. And so when I came back home, I presented myself. At first, it was a requirement for you to have a degree before you become a member of parliament. And so after I graduated, I announced my candidacy through a post on Instagram. And the next day, I got all the blogs, media stations were writing about it. And the thing about the nature of politics in my country is that once you present yourself, you still have to continue. Because if you back off, they will never trust you. So that's one of the things. And also, I joined the political space, and party politics also playing a huge role. So women and youth and women have challenges. So you can imagine what it felt for me to be both. So I had to carry all the challenges that young people face and the challenges that women face in politics. But I stayed and joined the Green Party later. And it was a successful campaign because to date, the tag Green MP is a public tag that I'm called by everyone in the country, but also because it inspired my friends from other countries to run for politics, just to fight for environmental issues. So that was trying to get to fight for what we are fighting outside from within the corridors of power.
Amazing, amazing. So what needs to change for Kenya to get more political action on climate change? You mentioned youth, you mentioned female empowerment. What needs to change?
I think, first of all, I will want to acknowledge that at least something has changed ever since we got this new government, is that our president speaks climate change every other time. And they even introduced a National Tree Planting Day, and so many people came out in large numbers. They introduced, our cabinet secretary, minister introduced, said that people will be given certificates, green certificates, you know, after planting a certain number of trees. So for me, I can say that one alone has influenced people, because people do follow what politicians do say as compared to what activists say or what advocates say. And so that played a huge role in bringing people together, and we are starting to see people coming together. The only thing that I may want to say needs to change in Kenya is there has to be capacity building for legislators, and these are members of parliament and senators who debate in the House. There has to be capacity building so that they can also understand these issues just as the president understands, just as the first lady understands, so that they can go to that House and allocate resources appropriately for climate-related issues, for adaptation, for mitigation, because they are the people who do allocate resources. And even though I did not manage to win elections, I got a chance to work. I work with the chairperson of Climate Change Committee in Senate, parliamentary group, and it's something that he's always wanted to do, but you realize that some of these challenges, resources and all that. So, but if the government realizes the importance of capacity building legislators, then they can finance such kind of projects so that we are not just capacity building youths, community members, and leaving behind our legislators who do the allocation of resources in parliament.
Of course, of course. But you may be slightly unfair on yourself there in saying that that the power is with the politicians rather than the activists. I think activists are absolutely necessary. And like you mentioned yourself, the great professor Wangari Maathai, Nobel Prize winner and real global leader from Kenya. What did you learn from Kenya's green activists from the past?
First of all, yeah, with your statement, for sure, activists are important. The only challenge that we have is that on this side, and not just in Kenya, but the African continent, is activism is not taken the same as what activism is really. Activism is not treated as what activism is. So activism is treated as being rebellious. And sometimes you'd find us introducing ourselves as climate advocates, not because we really want to distance ourselves from being called activists, but because of the consequences of identifying as an activist. You may lose opportunities because they will just think you're an enemy coming to fight in and all that. But I think from activists and great people like the late Professor Wangari Maathai, who was not just an environmental activist, but also a human rights activist. And she was also a member of parliament at some point. So she's also one of the inspiration when it comes to politics, matching politics and social issues, is that we've learned from the activists that no matter how hard the situation is, we do not give up fighting for what we believe in. As long as we continue to bring more voices, then we become a stronger voices as compared to working alone, working in silos. And it's also a challenge that we have in the youth space. Sometimes we work in silos, sometimes we don't work together. But learning from previous people like Professor Wangari Maathai, who brought so many people together to speak, we then realized the importance of coming together.
And what is it about tree planting that seems to have caught on in East Africa and become such a popular form of climate action?
Well, I think it's one of the easiest, I can say it's one of the easiest approaches to climate action, but also realizing that we are facing other challenges because of massive deforestation, that we have destroyed our own trees. That's why that's happening. If you look at science says that forests and oceans are great carbon sinks. So for us is that we have destroyed our forests, and so it's time to at least reforest our countries. But also another thing, like I said, it's something that people can do. Like I told you, when I started my journey, it started basically from tree planting. So I think it's a culture that we have grown. It's a ceremonial activity that happens after everything. After every ceremony, you realize that there's tree planting, ceremonial trees, and all that, because it also helps us to form memories and to celebrate days. For example, you can tell that this tree was planted in such a year during such and such a celebration. So it's also part of culture.
So I think one of the most inspirational things I've heard you say is the only qualification you need to conserve the environment is to live on the planet.
Yes.
And you've also, and like, again, just going back to like the simplicity of the tree, you've written a book called The Green War to explain the concepts and try and get the messaging of climate change out, regardless of education. So what are the barriers to making climate change accessible to everybody, regardless of education?
So first of all, why I say the only qualification you need to conserve the environment is the fact that you live in the planet. I mean, that's enough. It's because when I joined the space, I was joining university to pursue something different, public relations and corporate communication. And so I, at that time, when I wanted to change my university course to something related to environment conservation, I said, no, I can still be an environmentalist and still be in a different space. And so this was to try and make people understand that you don't have to be working in an environmental related field for you to be environmentally conscious. So you don't have to be in the Ministry of Environment for you to do it. And this was to encourage people that if you are in the field of fashion, you still have your contribution to climate action. If you are a doctor, there's still the nexus between health and climate. So I think that's the main reason why I brought out that message. And also when I was doing my education, ways of education, I realized that climate and environment stories are boring to youths and young people who don't subscribe to these things. So we have to find an interesting way of doing it. So with my team, we used to organize hiking activities. So we tell people that we are going hiking, we are going for a team building, and then in the process, just introduce climate-related either games or talks. And that really helped. That's what pulled people to our group. And I can say, most people in my team are people who just followed me online and that was it. But right today, they can speak about climate. We have our online classes. So I think it's also introducing fun ways. And I think it's already happening. We're already seeing organizations bringing together artists to perform so that they can talk about climate change. It's just about talking to people how they want to hear, not how we think it's right. So in a way that they understand, simplifying the language and making it fun.
Great. And can you tell us a little bit about your book?
Okay. So, yeah, my book, I wrote it in 2020. That was during COVID. And I did it before my 21st birthday. And what happened is during COVID, we were not going out anymore. We had our planned events that we had to cancel. We had to stay home. And so a friend of mine told me that maybe I should be writing articles. So he made me a website and I used to write a few chapters, what actually is in the book. And then it got to a point, I lost the website and I was like, what if I just take what I wrote and then put it together to a piece, and it becomes a book where we can give children, school children to read and all that. And another thing I was looking at, if I walk into a library to day to find a book on climate change, I'll find a huge book that talks about environment and so many sciences of the past and all that. But then I said, I'm just going to write something simple of how I understood climate change, that look, these and these that we're facing is what climate change is. So a simple book, a smaller book that anybody could read. And so that is how the book came about. And then it has been read most by children when it was not even a children's book. And that is because of its simplicity. Yeah.
So you're clearly a very passionate advocate for these causes, and you've had some really impressive experiences, such as going to COP, UN Youth Champion. Could you ask, what's your personal experience of attending COP over the last few years? Has it been like, have you been inspired or frustrated at the end of it?
I think every COP has its own different feelings. But I can say that one thing I appreciate is that every other COP since I attended the first one, and I think I've now done three, is that I've been able to see the change in numbers, more young people attending COP. I respect COP for it bring together leaders and people to be able to commit, and looking at what the COP28 was able to deliver, the adaptation funds, and what Dubai was able to make other countries do. I mean, I just appreciate because that it brings us together to look back at where we were, what was done, what was not done, and all that. But for me as an individual, from where I sit, and as someone who does not represent countries, I treat COP as an avenue for networking, avenue for showcasing, avenue for interacting, because it's because of the first COP that I attended that has been able to that enabled me to attend the other COPs and to attend other different conferences in between COPs. And so it's been a space where I have met new people who are doing similar work. It's a space where I've met people who I'm able to learn from their work, how I can be able to do my own work back in my country. And I've shared my stories that have equally inspired other people. So for me, that's how I treat COP.
Amazing, yeah. But as you kind of said before, you look at all sorts of different aspects. It isn't just focusing in on climate. You look at problems like water, gender. What's the connection between these issues?
The nexus between climate and other issues, I can say it's something that we can clearly see. And especially when we talk about water, because and also since I'm the Global Youth Champion for Sanitation and Water for All, most of the water, sanitation, and hygiene issues are brought about by climate change. It's because of droughts, it's because of lack of water that we cannot have proper hygiene management, proper menstrual hygiene management. And I mean, if you talk about lack of water, that's also lack of nutrition. Lack of water and changing weather patterns means changing rainfall distribution means it affects food production, and so food production is affected, and so hunger is here, and also the anxiety and the stress that comes with it, well-being, health and well-being. So if you look at climate, it's actually at the center of all the other SDGs. You can point all the poverty, and something I forgot to mention to you, that in my community, poverty has forced parents to even marry off young girls in exchange of cattle that they lost during drought. So it's an issue of human rights as well. So it's really, really interconnected, yeah. Because, and I can say because it depletes resources, it makes resources scarce, and now these resources then affect us in other social ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, part of the issue in this part of the world is we tend to be far too focused upon kind of one element, which is carbon. And we think if we can solve the carbon problem, then we solve all other problems. So we lose the importance of the interconnectedness of it all. Mm-hmm. So what in your personality makes you work in this kind of intersectional way? You know, rather than just looking at carbon as the one element, or as climate as the one element, what can we be learning from your experience about the interconnectedness and how your thought process works?
I think one thing that also influenced why I had to start a foundation that does other things apart from just climate and, you know, having that one issue, is that during elections, you tend to tell people that you are a green politician, a champion for green issues, and they have water shortage. They would think that you've told them that you want to solve climate crisis fast so that you can solve other issues, when clearly the other issues can be addressed along the way. So that's one of the things that made me realize that as much as climate is an issue, we shouldn't just ignore the other social issues that the other global community challenges that we have. So when it comes to climate and carbon, I think simply what we're trying to say is that we are experiencing climate change because of fossil fuels, carbon emissions and all that. But we are also experiencing climate change because there is no balance. So we are emitting, but we are not sequencing. So that brings us back to why in Africa we just do a lot of tree growing and all that. But also comes back to how are we also taking care of the marine life? Are we realizing the importance of marine conservation in that? And when you look at countries, for example, and this is a very controversial thing that I really want to speak into, but when you look at in our countries where we experience a lot of climate change, then even our emissions are not much. It's about like less than 3%. But I'm also looking at it from a point of no matter how much we are asking for support to be able to transition, is will we catch up when it comes to development? Because countries have developed with fossil fuels, then they got where now the planet is in a crisis. And so look, everybody we have to stop, including you, Kenya or Africa, that has less than 4%. And so for me, one thing that I always say when it comes to the discussion on carbon emissions, apart from the conversation on carbon credits, really, how is it beneficial to the farmer on ground, you know? Apart from all that politics, I believe that the first countries to face, last phase in, last phase out, so that it can also allow us to grow and to be at par with other countries.
Yeah, absolutely. There can be no transition that isn't a just transition. Fully agree with that. Yeah. But what do the people of Kenya need from the rest of the world so they can survive and flourish through climate change?
First of all, acknowledging the contribution that their contribution to climate crisis and working intentionally towards correcting that. So if anything, so they should match their words, you know, and actions, so that we don't just end up listening to promises and enjoying the promises when clearly nothing is being done. So being intentional and correcting the mess that they are still creating. Secondly is financing adaptation in our continent, because clearly contributing to it and leaving the burden to the same people who least contributed to it is not really fair. So I think it has to be financing adaptation in Africa, financing initiatives and supporting Africa to also have greener and at least to grow in a sustainable way. So finance is the major part, but also to reduce on their action.
So if I could just ask you one final question just to wrap up. So as a kind of young Maasai representative, what can the world learn from your community's perspective to help us all become better change makers?
I can say what the world should learn from the community is to learn that the communities, without being involved for a very long time, have still tried their best. Because most of the times what is discussed is what is good for this community is discussed without them. But still, over a period of time, with their own indigenous knowledge, they have tried to do things differently. For example, when it comes to restoration, they have their own ways that we call farmer-managed natural regeneration, where they grow the trees that grow underneath without having to plant trees, without having to water them, just pruning and staking. And after 5 years, the place is already green. So for me, I think that is one of the things that we have to borrow, and that is what it taught me to learn that when you go to communities, you don't just teach, you also listen. So it's good that they are also involved in what it meant for them, because they can also be part of the solution. And to learn that the communities like these that are on the forefront or on the worst, on the receiving end of the worst impacts of climate change, do not stop at being victims. They don't just end at being victims. They are also champions and on the forefront in trying to provide solutions in their own way.
That's a wonderful message, Neda. Thank you so much. It's very, you know, a lovely way to finish it. And I very much look forward to meeting you in person in Malta.
Thank you. See you.
Thank you very much for joining us on that conversation. We hope that you enjoyed it. Learned something. If you did enjoy it, please feel free to leave a 5-star review and to subscribe to any of our channels, and we'll be sure to keep you updated on future productions.
These are conversations that you just can't afford to miss.